This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Two central holidays for Jews and Christians are right around the corner, Passover and Easter. Both are based on those religions' holiest book, the Bible. For Jews, the story is the exodus from slavery in Egypt. For Christians, the story is the crucifixion of Jesus and his return from the dead on the third day. But what if those stories were not literally true? What if the ancestors of the Jews were never slaves? What if Jesus did not rise from the dead? What would happen to Judaism and Christianity? Today on Talk of the Nation, the intersection of fact and faith. We'll be talking about biblical archaeology. Archaeologists now cast doubt on some crucial parts of the Bible. We welcome your questions about what we know is fact, what we may not have been fact, and what is still open to question. We'd also like to know how important those facts are to your faith. And finally, we'll be talking a bit about how important even having this discussion is in the creation of an open society. Give us a call with your questions and your thoughts. Our telephone number, 800-989-TALK. That's 800-989-8255. Our email address, TOTN@NPR.org. Our guests for this hour have studied this subject and thought about it for quite a good while. Bruce Feiler is the author of Walking the Bible, A Journey by Land Through the Five Books of Moses. He's here in Studio 3A. And thanks for joining us. Good to see you again.
Nice to see you, Neil. Thank you for having me.
Rabbi Harold Kushner is co-author of Etz Chaim, The New Torah, and author of When Bad Things Happen to Good People. He's with us from member station WBUR in Boston, and welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Neil, thank you very much. This is a real reversal for me. I'm usually at the listening end of the program, fantasizing about what I would say if I were really a guest.
Well, hold that thought. Also with us, Jonathan Reed, a biblical field archaeologist, professor of religion at Laverne University, and co-author of the recently released Excavating Jesus Beneath the Stones Behind the Texts. And he's with us from our bureau in Los Angeles. And thank you for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Jonathan, why don't we start with you? Where have you been doing excavations?
Over the past 15 years, I've been excavating mainly in northern Israel, a site called Sepphoris, which was the capital city of Galilee at the time of Jesus, and also a village site called Capernaum.
And the question is, I guess, a question that archaeology almost started out with, can digs prove the Bible?
Well, I think if you look at the history of biblical archaeology, early on, biblical scholars wanted archaeology to be the handmaiden of biblical scholarship, to go out and find the sites that were talked about in the Bible, to find the artifacts that were talked about in the Bible. What has happened is when that relationship started, it was a handmaiden that was to speak when it was spoken to. And slowly over the last few decades, it has developed its own voice and is now crying out for the faith community to respond to its findings. And most of what has been found doesn't always confirm the historical accuracy of the Bible, either the New or Old Testament.
And Rabbi Kushner, as editor of this New Torah, you are coming to grips with, in fact, some of the discoveries that have been made.
Well, first of all, it's not a new Torah. We're perfectly happy with the traditional Torah. It's a new commentary on the Torah that the conservative movement has put out, and Chaim Potok and I did the writing for it. But yes, we're coming to grips with everything we've learned about how the Bible came to be in the last couple of generations. And I think my take would be that the Bible is true if you're willing to accept the idea that there's more than one way of being true. When the Bible tells me that King Ahaz died and was succeeded by his son Hezekiah, I'm perfectly prepared to believe that's exactly what happened. When the Bible tells me that Eve had a conversation with a talking snake, I'm prepared to believe that that's not precisely what happened, but that there is a deeper truth hidden there. And I think everything else in the Bible would fall somewhere between those two poles.
And Bruce Feiler, your book almost started out as a discourse on archaeology and became a journey to faith.
When I started out walking the Bible, I was obsessed with this issue of proof, the actual rock, the actual mountain, the actual body of water. And pretty quickly, even from the very earliest hours of this trip, when I went into eastern Turkey, into the Kurdish war zone to see Mount Ararat, and it is the tallest mountain in the Middle East, would be the second tallest mountain in Europe, and I realized the Bible may or may not be true. There may or may not have been a flood or an ark or a Noah. But if there was a Noah, and there was an ark, and there was a flood, almost assuredly this is the first piece of land that would have emerged out of the water. And it was clear to me that the people who were gathering and telling these stories had intimate knowledge of the landscape and the geography. And just to pick up briefly on what Rabbi Kushner said, from my point of view, the Bible is true, even if it's not always factual, and that that is a distinction that I would make between truths, which still speak to us today, and facts, which might have been changed or amended as they were passed down from generation to generation.
And before we get too many letters, Mount Ararat would be the second tallest mountain in Europe if it were in Europe.
Well, exactly. It's sort of, it's in sort of, it's the...
It's kind of right there on that
border. It's kind of right there in the border. It's like not quite sure where it is,
Having dismissed that point, probably the least controversial point.
Exactly, if that's what we get letters about. We're having a long hour here.
Okay. Now, a question. Did a group of Israelites come out of slavery in Egypt and settle in the area now called Palestine? And Jonathan Reed, is there any evidence of that?
Well, that's the problem. When you read the biblical text, it says that a group of maybe as many as 600,000 without children, maybe 1 million people left. And there's absolutely no evidence, concrete evidence, for that. People have sought and tried to look and find the site where the parting of the Red Sea happened, where the people of Israel would have gone and entered into the land. And for the Exodus, we find simply no concrete historical evidence. When you look at the conquest, what happens later under Joshua, you then begin to find some sites that seem to suggest that the Bible is historically accurate in some cases. There are sites mentioned in the Bible that are destroyed around the time when one would expect the conquest to have happened. But then there are other sites, such as Jericho, which had already been destroyed some 200 years before the Exodus should have happened.
And did Jericho have walls?
It did have walls, but they date to the wrong time. They're about 200 years too early. And for many years, archaeologists have fought, some of them trying to prove that the Bible is true and saying that these walls and the destruction layer, in fact, dates to the time of the Exodus and conquest. But most mainstream biblical archaeologists would say no, they're much earlier. So what's preserved there in the Bible is some historical recollection of something that happened much earlier.
Rabbi Kushner, when studies like this are publicized and the results are available to everybody, this is enormously controversial.
It's enormously controversial for people whose faith is so shaky that they have to believe that every single blessed word of the Bible is historically accurate. There is a truth to the Exodus story, whether it happened exactly the way it did with the sea splitting a la Cecil B. DeMille or not. It doesn't bother me if the editor of the Book of Joshua appropriated an earlier story of how the city was taken and incorporated into the story of the conquest, because he was trying to make a point. And the point was that the Israelites occupied Canaan as part of a mission from God, and not simply as an act of conquest. There is evidence of Egyptian roots to the earliest stages of Israel. There are Egyptian names: Moses, Aaron, Pinchas. These are all Egyptian names. There's the question of why people would make up a story like that when it doesn't reflect so well on them. And there's the fact that as far back as we can trace it, way back into First Temple times, the Israelite memory was that they were slaves in Egypt and God brought them out. And I don't know how you manufacture a collective memory like that if there isn't some kernel of truth to it. Were there 10 plagues? Maybe, maybe not. Did the sea split? I don't know, but somehow the Israelites got across. Were they fed manna in the desert for 40 years? Something happened to sustain them. The actual petty details are less important to me than the grand theme. The grand theme is that Israel remembered its founding in an act of intervention by God that declared, human beings shall not be owned by other human beings. Human beings are meant to be free. Everything from 3,000 years ago to Jewish voting patterns in the last election have been shaped by that collective memory.
Jonathan Reed, are there similarly critical moments in the New Testament which have fallen short in terms of archaeology?
Well, once again, it's the lack of evidence that's a little bit puzzling. In the Hebrew Bible, the further back one goes in history, the less evidence one has. When you get to King Hezekiah or the prophets, let's say Amos, the Bible pretty much fits what you have in archaeology. The further back you go, conquest, Exodus, Noah, Abraham, the less evidence there is. It's very similar with early Christianity. The closer you get to Jesus, the less actual evidence there is for Jesus. We have evidence and inscription from Pontius Pilate that was found, who was involved in the trial and crucifixion. We have evidence of the high priest Caiaphas, who was involved in the trial and crucifixion. This is archaeological evidence. But for Jesus, we have nothing. And part of the reason is that Jesus, as part of a peasant culture, as part of the lower classes, more or less flew under the radar and was not someone who would leave behind inscriptions or papyri or monuments to himself.
Our telephone number, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address, totn@npr.org. Our first caller is Yona, who joins us from Sacramento, California.
Yeah, hi.
Hi.
I have a question I always wanted to ask in this kind of discussion. My point is that science and the Bible should really remain separate investigations. If you consider the Bible only as a historical document, it's fine. Otherwise, any effort to confirm one against the other is doomed. And the reason I'm saying that is that God is part of the Bible, at least by believers. And if we introduce God into the effort, he opens a whole new discussion. Since we believe that God is all-powerful, the possibility that he can alter easily any archaeological evidence has to be considered.
And Rabbi Kushner, this would seem to be in your bailiwick.
Yeah, I would agree with Yona that for the most part, science and religion offer different answers to different questions. And you misuse science when you try and use scientific methods to prove faith. And you misuse religion when you use the revelation of the Bible to try and tell you something that it's not there to tell, like how long it took to create the world, or was there a flood, or was there a plague of frogs in Egypt some 3,200 years ago. But there are historical truths which come out of the Bible, even if they're only 50, 70, 80% accurate. Mm-hmm. The idea that slaves went free and saw that as the hand of God, to me that is an enduring truth, whether the Exodus story is accurate in its details or whether it embellished some of those details to magnify the role of God.
Bruce Feiler?
Yeah, I was just going to say, I agree with the caller here that we can take science and we can take the Bible and we can tug them toward each other and we can get them to touch and maybe occasionally we can get them to overlap, but we're never going to get them to sit right on top of each other. Even if we can find evidence of a flood and it's a universal flood, even if we can find a boat that's the size of a soccer field, three stories tall, as the Bible says Noah's Ark is, and even if we find a sign that says Noah built me, we're still not going to find evidence that God commanded Noah to build this ark.
And nor are we going to figure out how he managed to get all of two of each animal into that soccer-sized.
Or where the food came from and where they actually put the dung when they, you know, all this kind of stuff. And the point is that we're not going to find a lost tape of God like some lost Beatles recording that we can digitally remaster and put on the internet. It's just not going to happen. And I think the thing that struck me is traveling across the Middle East, talking to scholars, pilgrims, Bedouin, politicians, is that this issue comes up much less in the Middle East than it comes up here. I met an archaeologist in Jerusalem who said to me, there's this idea, particularly in America and in Europe, that if I can prove that two screws existed, I can prove that the whole thing existed. I'm not going to find those screws, he said, and it doesn't matter to me. I know that the stories are real. So the people who live there know that the stories have great connection to the places, and it's us farther away not knowing the places who seem to have this need for the proof.
Yet some of these stories, critical stories, are more important, it would seem, to the religion than others. If there was no Exodus, clearly the Jewish religion has to rethink itself, does it not?
But the point is, even if archaeology cannot prove that there was an Exodus, it also cannot disprove that there was an Exodus. Even if you take the story at its own word that they were wandering for 40 years in the desert, the thing is, they would have been using tents and rugs, and they would have left nothing behind. You don't build monuments if you are a transient people. So the absence of evidence in and of itself does not prove anything.
Yona, thank you very much for the call.
Thank you.
We're talking this hour about biblical archaeology. How important is it to you that the Bible and Torah are factually true? And we'll take more of your calls at 800-989-TALK when we come back from a short break, or you can send us email, totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Thank you. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking this hour about whether the Bible and Torah are factually accurate and how biblical archaeology helps sort all of this out. By the way, for those of you waiting news on the decision of the Federal Reserve Board on interest rates, they have just announced that interest rates will not be changed. So no change in the federal interest rates. That's announced just now by the Federal Reserve. Anyway, our guests for this hour, Bruce Feiler, he's the author of Walking the Bible, A Journey by Land Through the Five Books of Moses. Rabbi Harold Kushner, co-editor of Etz Chaim, a new commentary on the Torah and author of When Bad Things Happen to Good People. Jonathan Reed is also with us. He's a biblical field archaeologist and co-author of Excavating Jesus, Beneath the Stones, Behind the Text. Of course, you're invited to join our discussion, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, and our email address is TOTN@NPR.org. And let's go back to the phones. Our next caller is Miranda, who's in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Hi. Hello?
Yes, you're on the air.
Okay, thank you for having me on. I just wanted to say that I don't think that the factual veracity of the Bible is very important to using it in the modern day. My family is Jewish, and when we celebrate the Passover Seder, we don't only talk about the exodus from Egypt of our ancestors, but we talk about modern-day issues of slavery and oppression and how important it is to look at other places in the world where those things are still happening. And so we use the Bible not as a factual guide work for our own lives, but as a way to look at the important things that are happening currently. And we have wonderful conversations with friends and family. About last year, we talked about slaves in the Sudan. And so we use it as a tool. And I don't think that it needs to be factually true in order to be able to be used in that way.
Rabbi Kushner, that seems to make your point.
Oh, absolutely. And I agree with Miranda that the Exodus story is real, whatever the historicity may be, because it affects the way people live today, as the story of the resurrection is real, whether it happened or not. There will be Christians 12 days from now who will feel very differently about themselves, their moral failings, their future, because they feel cleansed and forgiven and redeemed by the account of the resurrection. There will be Jews next week, myself among them, who will not only eat matzah for a week, but will be soft touches for charitable appeals for the oppressed everywhere, because we have grown up reciting the story of God's intervention on behalf of the slaves spring after spring. Those stories are real because they have real impact in the lives of real people.
Jonathan Reed, I heard you trying to get in there.
Well, that's exactly where you have the gap, the difference between science and faith, archaeology and faith. And it's both in the Hebrew Bible for Jews today and in the New Testament for Christians today. If you look at the evidence and there's no archaeological evidence, so to speak, for the Exodus, that doesn't disprove it, as Bruce said. You have the exact same thing with the crucifixion and resurrection. What archaeological evidence can you find for the resurrection? Well, an empty tomb. That's not exactly proof that it happened, but it also doesn't disprove it. The more important thing is, I think, as Rabbi Kushner says, is the meaning of the Exodus and the meaning of the resurrection today, not the fact.
You know, Neil, I would love to hear from liberal Christians out there as to whether they are capable of accepting the story of the crucifixion and resurrection as a metaphor rather than a historical event without diminishing their faith, the way liberal Jews can accept the story of the Exodus as a type, as a narrative, the founding narrative of the Jewish people, and not necessarily a historical record.
And accepting all the time that there are certainly some Orthodox Jews and fundamentalist Christians who accept the Bible as literally true.
Absolutely.
Okay. Miranda, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you very much.
Jonathan Reed, I meant to ask you, in biblical archaeology, and I understand some people don't use that term anymore, but if proving or disproving the Bible is no longer the organizing principle of archaeology in that part of the world, what is? How do you decide what to go look for?
Well, instead of trying to prove or disprove the Bible, either the Hebrew Bible or the New Testament, what archaeology today tends to do is try to provide the context mm-hmm. within which we can understand the biblical tradition and the faith traditions. And that's a big difference. I'll give you an example from New Testament scholarship. Probably the two most important sites for excavating Jesus and trying to find out Jesus' first century context are Gamla and Yodfat, two Jewish villages that are never mentioned in the New Testament. And the reason they're important is because archaeologists can go there and excavate those sites which have not been contaminated by later Christian Byzantine basilicas, shrines, and chapels, so that to find out what was Jewish life like in the first century in Galilee and northern Israel, you have to go to sites that aren't mentioned in the Bible.
And would that, Bruce Feiler, explain that, you know, the larger social context of the stories about Jesus and that time of existence?
I think what Jonathan said is exactly right, and that what the stories can do and what archaeology can do, even if we can't prove that Jesus said this or Abraham went there, is that the context of the stories, the idea that there were Semitic tribes in Mesopotamia who left and came down into Canaan in the early second millennium, that is definitely factual. The idea that there were outsiders who were living in Egypt in the middle of the second millennium, as Joseph was, that is factual. There's a moment in the text where Joseph rises to become second in command to the Pharaoh. He puts a signet ring on, and I think he gets a cloak or something. That is accurate to what was going on in Egypt at the time. And the point is, 1,000 years later, when the story was written down, they didn't have libraries they could go to check these details. So it's clear time and again, and I certainly found as I was retracing the Bible, that the people who were gathering the story had intimate knowledge of the culture, and those details just simply could not have been invented. They wouldn't have been known 1,000 years later.
As you walked some of this area,
yeah,
did it make geographical sense? Did these stories, as you walked the places where they were, about which they were told, did it make sense that this happened here and that happened there?
As you travel in the Sinai, you travel from oasis to oasis. The Sinai is this giant isosceles triangle wedged between Africa and Asia. It's 24,000 square miles of nothing. Still today, 40,000 Bedouin in an area the size of Ireland.
Mm-hmm.
And you travel from oasis to oasis.
You UN observers, too.
Yes, well, okay. The UN observers are up to the north. And there's one oasis called the Oasis of the Tamarisk Trees. A tamarisk is a conifer that grows naturally in the desert. In the springtime, a plant lice crawls into the trunk, eats the wood, processes it, then excretes a white, sweet, sticky substance that forms into globules and falls to the ground. You can come along in the mornings and pick up and eat, but if you don't pick it up by midday, it will melt. And the Bedouins still call this substance manna. And if you go home tonight and open your Bible, you'll read about a white, sweet, sticky substance that forms into globules and falls to the ground that the Israelites pick up in the mornings and eat, but if they don't by midday, it will melt. Again, if you're sitting in Babylon or Jerusalem 1,000 years later, you're not going to know about this. The people knew about the natural terrain they were talking about.
Our next caller is Josh, who's on the line with us from Los Angeles.
Hi.
Hi.
Well, this is what I want to say, is that the Bible doesn't claim to be factual or historical. We've been over that. But modern scholarship holds this axiom that things that are perceived to be outside of nature, like miracles and supernatural events, things like the Exodus and the resurrection, couldn't have happened. And I think that God could have created this world that is run by nature, but also allowed for these kinds of miraculous events. And I'm curious how come modern scholars and the gentleman on the show have a problem with accepting the reality of these miraculous events actually happening.
Mm-hmm. Now, are what faith are you, sir?
If you go by my answer, I'm an Orthodox Jew.
And would it matter to you then if some discovery was made that somebody could definitively say, you know, the Exodus did not happen?
Well, personally, I think it would matter a bit to me, because in the Passover Seder, we actually are told to believe as if we actually came out. Now, we've said that, you know, can have metaphorical meaning, and that the Bible never actually says that you have to believe this as historical truth. But I think in some way it would kind of delegitimize the event, what the Bible teaches us in our lives.
Rabbi Kushner?
Yeah, to me, the miracle is that the laws of nature hold so constantly, not that they are periodically suspended. Although Josh may be familiar with the Midrash that when God created the world, he built in a kind of alarm clock, let's say, where seas don't split except for one particular sea on one particular date at one particular hour. Some people find that comforting. What I find fascinating is that the editors of the Torah tried to minimize the degree of divine intervention and suspension of natural law, so that if you read the story of the splitting of the Red Sea, there's this apparently gratuitous reference to a strong east wind blowing the waters apart. Now, why mention the east wind? Why not just say that God divided the sea? Because I think the editors didn't want to demand of the reader that they accept the suspension of natural law. They wanted to find God working within natural law. The miracle was not that waters suddenly went in two different directions. The miracle was that people who were slaves found their way across that sea with the confidence to cross because they thought that God was on their side and guiding them.
Josh?
Very beautifully said.
and we're not asking you to get into a discourse with a famous rabbi here.
I have a lot of respect for Rabbi Kushner.
Okay. Well, then, thanks for the call.
Have a wonderful day, guys.
We will. Thanks very much. Now let's go to Ian, and Ian is with us from Louisville, Kentucky.
Yes, I just wanted to make a comment that I am a Christian, a Catholic that has strong beliefs in the Bible, but I don't take it literally. But as I went through RCIA to become a Catholic, the priest said, if you look at the Old Testament and the New Testament as a human's relationship with a God, and the stories are passed down, and as in anything else in modern times or Greek mythological times, we exaggerate our exploits. And if you look at it that way and take it away, my faith has increased immensely of looking at it from our relationship with God.
Mm-hmm. Bruce Feiler?
Yeah, I just wanted to make a point, which is I agree with the caller, and that is I think for me and for a lot of people who are raised in this culture in a rational, historical-based world, the presence of this conversation doesn't end up diminishing the text or diminishing our faith. If anything, I think it enhances us because it obliges us to engage the text in a more interactive way. I think the lesson of they weren't writing a history textbook that we could come back 5,000 years later with a computer chip and an abacus. They were telling a story about themselves and about this world and giving us guidance for our own lives. And the point is, I think the absence of history makes us determine and make a voluntary choice to believe it or not to believe it based on faith, which ultimately, I think, enhances our faith. So it's it's an unexpected consequence of this archaeological debate, but I think it actually makes it more real to people because they engage it not as children who are just told it's true, but as adults with all of the nuances that we bring to it as adults.
And Ian, I wonder about Rabbi Kushner's question earlier, and I don't mean to label you without knowing anything about you as a liberal Christian or a liberal Catholic, but could you accept the idea of the crucifixion and the rising from the dead as a metaphor rather than as fact?
Absolutely, because I have had strong dreams of a child that keep on reliving in memory. And just the lessons of Christ teaching me are very powerful. To love your neighbor is very powerful. Life is so much happier when you extend love and humanity towards someone. And that memory to stay with me, that is just as strong a physical resurrection as a mental resurrection to keep me thinking about it. You know, the Easter season, reviewing that and going, hey, I really need to concentrate on this by thinking about money and my next paycheck. It's a very strong belief to go back to, that I don't have to have the literal rising, but a rising that we may not understand. It doesn't have to be a physical hopping up.
Okay.
Walking around. To me, to believe that faith and that message, that is very strong.
Yet the central tenet, or a central tenet of Christianity, is that through Jesus, who rose from the dead after 3 days, that there is an afterlife for us all.
Yeah, but what is that afterlife? I question what that afterlife is, but it's not something that I can put in words to describe and guarantee to you.
Okay.
And I think
if I can jump in.
Go ahead.
If I can jump in, one of the problems I think we have is that we don't live in a pre-Enlightenment world anymore. We live in a post-Enlightenment world. In antiquity, miracles as miracles were expected to occur in everyday life, and nobody had a problem with it. In the Exodus, that a deity would come and do something for his or her people that would be miraculous was expected in antiquity. What was odd is that this deity chose slaves to become free. That's a bit weird in antiquity. With the resurrection, nobody in the first century Roman world doubted resurrections. Julius Caesar resurrected, Caesar Augustus resurrected. There are many stories of many people resurrecting. What was unique about Jesus is that this was a Jewish peasant who had been crucified by the Romans. So there's a political angle to this as well. It's not just a matter of believing in the supernatural or not.
Ian, thanks very much for the call.
Well, thank you.
Appreciate it. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And this seems to be a question to you, Jonathan Reed. What can your guest tell us about what I, as a professional archaeologist, this is an email from Sean Rafferty, PhD, from what I, as a professional archaeologist, see as a central failure of biblical archaeology, that it ignores the central goal of modern archaeology, that being to tell the story of everyday people, of society as a whole, not the story of grand but rare, if not metaphorical, events.
Well, I think that's a complete failure of biblical archaeology that has to do with the fact that what archaeology was to do was to find monuments that related to the history of Israel, kings, and priests primarily. I think what you've seen in the last 10 or 15 years is a movement away from that, to look at gender issues, to look at village life, and to move away from the grand, from the monumental. I would say it's more or less in its infancy, and some of the leaders in that field are Eric and Carol Myers, who have worked for many years in villages in the Galilee to try to understand exactly what village life is like, what life of the common people was like, as opposed to the urban elites.
Rabbi Kushner, I wonder if there is yet another edition of Etz Chaim. Would you be glad to incorporate those kinds of findings in it?
Well, I think we've incorporated a lot of that. The essays, the commentary itself touches lightly on archaeology and doesn't get into these controversial issues. The essays in the appendix are pretty up-to-date in terms of what archaeology can tell us, what it can't tell us. And it anticipates what Dr. Reed just said, that it's shedding light not on whether there was an Abraham, but how nomads lived at about that period, not whether King David had an affair with Bathsheba, but what the dimensions of Jerusalem were in the year 1000 when David came to the throne. And I think that's what they can show. Everyday life, last time I was in Jerusalem, I visited a building known as the Burnt House. It belonged to a lower echelon priest at the time of the destruction of the temple, just about the time of Jesus. And it showed the kind of homes people had, the furniture they had, the baths they had. And it was precisely what this Dr. Rafferty said archaeology ought to be doing. We're getting the message and we're moving in that direction.
We're going to take more of your calls when we come back after a short break. We're talking about faith and whether it's important that one's faith be based on fact. Is faith measured differently than rationality? And by the way, you can continue this conversation online. Just go to npr.org, click on the discussion section, then scroll down to Talk of the Nation. Tomorrow, we are staging a debate on Talk of the Nation, and we need your help. Robert Kuttner of the liberal magazine The American Prospect and Grover Norquist of the conservative Americans for Tax Reform will both be here in the studio to debate this issue. Resolved. The Enron affair is the logical result of deregulation. We want to know what your questions are for these two guests. Email your questions for Kuttner and Norquist to totn@npr.org. In the subject line, please type debate questions. Then tune in to hear Kuttner and Norquist answer your questions and slug it out here in the studio tomorrow at this time. You're listening to Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, on the web at macfound.org, the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, seeking to improve people's lives by supporting the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and child abuse prevention, and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, helping all students to achieve by sponsoring small high schools and expanding access to higher education. GatesFoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Jay Gatsby, Scarlett O'Hara, and Winnie the Pooh may have little in common except that they're all on Book Magazine's list of the 100 best fictional characters of the century. The list includes Holly Golightly and the Cat in the Hat. I'm Neil Conan. What makes a good fictional character great? That's the next Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Thank you.
This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. This hour, we're talking about how biblical archaeology enhances or diminishes faith and religion. Our guests are Bruce Feiler, the author of Walking the Bible, A Journey by Land Through the Five Books of Moses, Rabbi Harold Kushner, co-editor of Etz Chaim, a new commentary on the Torah and author of When Bad Things Happen to Good People, and Jonathan Reed, a biblical field archaeologist, professor of religion at the University of Laverne in Laverne, California, and currently editing a book on archaeology and the history of Israel. To join the conversation, give us a phone call, 800-989-TALK, our email address, totn@npr.org. Do you think the Bible is an historical document? And what happens in a society when people begin questioning what were previously accepted as faith and dogma? Again, our telephone number is 800-989-8255. And our next caller is Brad, who's on the line from Washington, D.C.
Thank you for my call. The discussion so far this hour has been mostly about whether these kinds of findings affect our faith in religion, and my question is actually sort of a little different. Understanding that speakers aren't political scientists or politicians, I wonder how they think these kinds of findings might affect Jewish and Israeli claims to the land itself, as you know, are sort of being played out now in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. I mean, as a Jew growing up, I sort of learned that our claims to Hebron, for example, came from, you know, Abraham's
tomb.
Purchase and you know, getting title to the city in Genesis. If Abraham didn't exist, how do I process, you know, that kind of claim now?
Jonathan Reed, I wonder if you have some insights on this.
Well, I was hoping to raise that issue, not answer it. That's a hot one. That's a very difficult question. I think it's clear in the history of scholarship that part of what is happening is that the archaeological understanding of the Exodus, and particularly the conquest, have an awful lot to do with how people perceive themselves in the land today and their place in the land. So it is being argued about. You have people who would go so far, and I don't believe in this, that the Hebrew Bible is more or less, these are minimalists or revisionists who would see that the Hebrew Bible is nothing more but pious fiction. It is, in fact, Jewish propaganda from the Hellenistic period to stake a claim to the land. So the point of that argument would be, of course, to say that Israel today has no right to the land. That's a minority position, but it shows quite clearly how archaeologists and their findings are used for political purposes today.
Neil, may I jump in on this, please?
First, Rabbi Kushner, then Bruce Feiler. Okay. Everybody wants
Thank
in
you.
On this one.
I think that the legitimacy of Jewish settlement in specific places may be a stretch, but I think the legitimacy of Israel as the homeland of the Jewish people is beyond dispute. That is, certainly this is the part of the world where the Israelites lived, created the Bible, wrote the Psalms, heard the prophets. That is beyond dispute. When an Arafat says that there never was a temple in Jerusalem, it seems to me that not only Jews but Christians ought to be outraged, because there's so many stories about Jesus interrelating with the temple, Jesus preaching at the temple, Jesus visiting the temple, and that's not something you can wish away. Now, it's one thing to say that the Bible documents that Israel is where the Jewish people lived and was creative. It's something else to say that the borders of a Jewish state can be determined by the stories of where the patriarchs wandered or where the various tribes were active. And that, I think, becomes a political and not a religious historical issue.
And picking up on what Robert Kushner just said, I think the text tells us inadvertently perhaps quite a lot. The entire Five Books of Moses takes place on the Fertile Crescent. The upper arm is Mesopotamia. There was an empire there. The lower arm is the Nile. There was an empire there. And if you think of the Fertile Crescent as being like a modern American shopping mall, basically two anchor stores on either end, and how their strength depended on the strength of the boutique stores in the middle. And what happened in antiquity was Mesopotamia would control the Promised Land for a while, Egypt would push them back and forth that they went. And the point is, when God came to promise the land, there was an empire up in Mesopotamia and one in Egypt. He promised them the Promised Land. So this land, which has been notoriously difficult to control for the last 3,000 years, became that way in large measure because it had been notoriously difficult to control for the preceding 3,000 years. It's a strategically complex piece of land that no one's ever going to control. And ultimately, it's always been about power politics, this land, and it's always going to be about power politics. The Palestinians, just briefly, the Jewish claim to the land traditionally has been, God promised us this land. But even the Jewish text says it was occupied. So the Palestinians came along 15 years ago and said, well, your land says, your story says the Canaanites were here. Guess what? We're descended from the Canaanites. Oddly enough, the sooner that we decouple the texts from the situation, I think the more likely we are to find it. And just to, what the questioner said was about Hebron. The Israelis gave Hebron to the Palestinians because it's a predominantly Palestinian community. And so if the the earliest places they gave back...
With some important exceptions.
Yeah, well, with a very minor group who are 500 who are living 2 minutes away and 6,000 who are living 10 minutes away.
Mm-hmm.
So I just think the point is the current state of Israel actually bears very little resemblance to the Promised Land, which went all the way from the Nile to the Euphrates. And in fact, very few people in Israel, there you can find a few, mm-hmm. are going to try to claim that for the modern state of Israel.
Brad, thanks very much for the call. I wanted to follow that up with an email we got from Paul Friedman. It's true Middle Eastern Jews and Arabs don't need archaeological underpinnings for their faith, but that may be why the faiths in practice end up in conflict. No mutually acceptable and neutral referee of truth. And I was wondering, Rabbi Kushner, if you would like to address that.
Well, I think that's true. What you have there is not a religious quarrel in the Middle East. You have a political, geographic quarrel, which then gets theologized. And when that happens, boy, have you got problems. Mm-hmm. Because you can compromise geography, you can compromise politics, you can't compromise religion. Once you go beyond saying, this is the land that our people has always dreamt of living in and lived in historically, and make that a statement about this is the land that God wants us to have, it's very hard to compromise on that, whether you're an Israeli or a Palestinian. And it seems to me that the sooner you move this argument out of the theological sphere and into the historical, geographical, political sphere, that is, there is a Jewish people, it has historical roots in this part of the world, it needs and deserves and is entitled to a place to live. There is a Palestinian people, they have to live somewhere, even if it's not the same place they were living in 1947. Their needs as human beings must be accommodated. At that point, you can work out a compromise. Once you start saying what this is God's will and you're going against God, who's going to compromise with that?
Another email we got, and I can't pronounce the writer's name, so I apologize for that, but why is the Quran not included in this discussion is the question. And I wanted to try to include it, and not that any of you may be experts on the Quran itself or on Quranic scholarship, but also to raise one question that sort of came up earlier in the program, and that had to do with the Enlightenment, which at least in part revolved around the idea of critical thinking about things, including the veracity indeed of the Bible, and how that affects open societies. And Jonathan, well, Bruce Feiler.
Yeah, I'll say something about that because I've been working on a book about Abraham and have been deeply involved in this question. And it's important to say here that the Quran, which was dictated to Muhammad in the 7th century, according to Islamic tradition, is very referential, actually. It's written in a way that says, remember when the people of the book say this. Remember when
the book
says this.
Unlike the Bible, it does start by saying this book is not to be doubted.
Well, because it is, the Bible has a wide variety of narrative techniques, third-person dialogue, poetry, law. The Quran is entirely in the voice of God, and that's one of the reasons for the passion it elicits. But the point I was making is there are far fewer details. It never, particularly the stories about that are covered in the Hebrew Bible and in the New Testament, they are not retold, they are referenced. So even, and they're referenced, alluding to as they are told in the book and in the Hebrew Bible and in this case the New Testament. So the point is, even when you're trying to piece together the story, it is not contradictory to the Quran to say, the Bible has all the details, so let us look there.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think that we're being offensive to anybody by focusing Abraham, for example, who is vital, maybe more important to Islam than to Christianity, and arguably as important as to Judaism.
You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Rabbi Kushner, I was wondering if you wanted to talk about that.
Only to say that for me, the truthfulness of the Quran does not depend on whether the angel Gabriel really spoke to Muhammad. How's anybody going to prove or disprove that? The truthfulness is that it moves hundreds of millions of people to live very devoted lives, to give charity where they not, might not be inclined to pray regularly, to fast during Ramadan, and to be people of religious commitment. In the same way, for example, that I can have great, great admiration for the kind of human beings that the Mormon Church, the Church of the Latter-day Saints of Jesus Christ, turns out, without having to believe the story of Joseph Smith finding the golden tablets. I don't have to question the veracity of that. I don't have to affirm the veracity of that. All I have to do is admire the kind of polite, generous, disciplined, decent, moral human beings that are shaped by the Mormon tradition.
See if we could get Mike in on the conversation. He's in Lovell, Wyoming.
How you doing?
All right.
Good, good. I just wanted to throw my two cents in here, and I don't really believe that any absolute truths have ever been written down in any book that, according to the laws and doctrines of the mystery schools of antiquity, they were always passed by mouth to ear. And I think that's what a lot of the Bible is supposed to be, is allegorical more than literal. And I think that's where a lot of damage has come along throughout the generations, is by actually taking the Bible as a literal way in, of understanding.
And yet the entire tradition, and I guess any of you can answer this, had been, I guess until, what, 150, 200 years ago, to accept the Bible as literal truth.
Yeah, I actually would be dying to make this point all hour, and that is, this whole conversation is about whether the absence of historical details undermines faith of people today. The truth is, the period of time, historically, when history was the foundation is a relatively brief period. That's been only since, say, the beginning of the 20th century. Mm. Forever until the 18th century, until around 1800, the Bible was just true. It was the Word of God. It was the Word of the Bible. It wasn't, no one argued about this. And it's only now us in the post-Enlightenment, as Jonathan Reed mentioned, that we've even cared about it as being part of history. So the absence of history, paradoxically, is bringing us closer to how people engage the Bible for 2,000 years, even though it's taking us farther away from than the way people might have engaged it 50 years ago.
One more caller, and that is Kim in San Francisco.
Hi. I am a struggling Catholic, and as such, I've had to look pretty closely at faith and at the Bible, and I've come to the conclusion that if I were God, if there is a God, and if I were God, I wouldn't necessarily want to have proof available, because the whole idea of faith is that faith is hard. It's hard because you know that there are facts that contradict what you believe. You know that there are people that will laugh at you. You know for believing certain things. And it's supposed to be that way, is my thinking. The other thing is, Jesus was a peasant. The Jews were slaves. It's so funny how our culture, for all the people that are talking about the Bible and religion, it is so odd how this culture doesn't respect the lowly, how America today really respects materialism and wealth, and how back then there was a profound respect for the lower class and the morals of right and wrong and the haves and the have-nots. But anyway, I think it's all about faith, and faith is hard.
Rabbi
Kim,
Kushner, yeah.
Yeah, right on for the second point, Ken. On your first point, would you permit me to make a distinction between things that go beyond reason and things that go against reason? I think religion at its best goes beyond reason. Religion at its most vulnerable goes against reason.
Right.
That's an interesting way to put it. That going back to the talking snake.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Okay.
Well, my 15 second response to that is, the destination during all those 40 years in the desert is the Promised Land. The Promised Land is Israel. Israel means the place where one struggles with God. It's not the place where one has certitude. It's not the place where one has all the answers. The destination is the struggle.
Kim, thanks very much for the call. We appreciate it.
Sure.
And thanks to all of our guests. You just heard from Bruce Feiler, the author of Walking the Bible, A Journey by Land Through the Five Books of Moses. Thanks for coming in.
My pleasure.
Bruce Feiler was here in Studio 3A. Rabbi Harold Kushner is the co-editor of Etz Chaim, a new commentary on the Torah, and author of When Bad Things Happen to Good People. And he spoke with us at the studios of member station WBUR in Boston. Thank you.
Thank you, Neil.
Jonathan Reed, a field archaeologist, professor of religion at the University of Laverne in Laverne, California, co-author of Excavating Jesus Behind the Stones Behind the Text, Beneath the Stones Behind the Text, and he joined us from our bureau in Los Angeles. Thank you.
Thank you.
In Washington, I'm Neil Conan, NPR News.